Carmen LaSalle here, welcoming you to the kickoff of Media Alliance's 30th birthday celebration, a conversation between Alice Walker, a foremost American writer and activist, and Amy Goodman, the host of the television program Democracy Now! This took place at the First Congregational Church in Oakland, California on January 27, 2006. At the beginning of part one, you will hear Nicole Sawaya of KALW-FM in San Francisco introducing Amy and Alice.
Please join me in welcoming these truly exceptional women, Alice Walker and Amy.
Well, it is a great honor to be here with all of you celebrating Media Alliance, always celebrating KPFA. Thank you to the great woman Nicole Sawaya, right there on the forefront of media struggles. And to be here celebrating this great woman, anti-warrior, Alice Walker. I was just saying to Alice that I think one of the last times that I saw her was right before the invasion. It was International Women's Day, March 8th, 2003. She was standing in front of the White House with Maxine Hong Kingston, Terry Tempest Williams, and a number of other women. It wasn't a large group, about 15 or so women. And they stood there, arms locked, and the police told them to move, and they said no. And they all got arrested. We were trying to get their message out on community radio. I was interviewing them on the cell phone. The police didn't appreciate that, so. Really, the last time I saw her was in the prison cell with her. But Alice, you said that day, as we were in the paddy wagon or in the police wagon, that it was the happiest day of your life. Why?
Well, you were there. I have so much admiration for this woman and so much love for Amy. She's so incredibly wonderful and she's doing such good work in the world. And I feel so proud of her. So I was very happy that she had appeared to talk to us about why we were there. Nobody else was asking. And so there we were, arrested in this patrol thing. And actually, I did feel incredibly happy, because what happens when you want to express your outrage, your sorrow, your grief — grief is basically where we are now, you know, just bone chilling grief — when you're able to gather your own forces and deal with your own fears the night before, and you arrive, you show up, and you put yourself there, and you know that you're just a little person. You know, you're just a little person. And there's this huge machine that's going relentlessly pretty much all over the world. And then you gather with all the other people who, you know, just as small as you are, but you're together. And you actually do what you have set out to do, which is to express total disgust, disagreement, disappointment about the war in Iraq, about the possibility of it starting up again. All these children, many of them under the age of 15, about to be just terrorized, brutalized, and killed, so many of them. So to be able to make any kind of gesture that means that the people who are about to be harmed will know that we are saying we don't agree. Just the ability to do that made me so joyful. I was completely happy. And I think that we could learn to live in that place of a full self-expression against disaster and self-possession and happiness.
You have had a continued relationship with the police officer who put handcuffs on you.
Yes. because he really didn't want to do it. And I could see that they really did not want to arrest us. And he, this African-American man, truly did not want to arrest me. And I totally understand that. Would you want to arrest me? No. No, no, you would not. So even as they were handcuffing me, they were sort of apologizing, like, oh, you know, because I also thought that you put the handcuffs like, oops, you know, your hands in front, but they put them behind you. I hadn't really noticed that before. And so there was some amount of apology. And then later, after we were released, you know, they take your shoes. So I was there trying to put my shoes back on. And he came over and he got down on his knees and he said, let me help you. And I said, sure, oops. And I put my foot out and he helped me with my shoes and we started talking about his children. Well, first of all, he told me about his wife. He said, you know, when I told my wife that I had arrested you, she was not thrilled. And so then I asked him about his family, and he told me about his children, and I told him I write children's books. And so he said, oh, you do? Because, you know, there's nothing to read. The children are all watching television. I said, that's true. So it ended up with me sending books to them and feeling that this is a very good way to be with the police. And can I just extrapolate a little bit on the police and us? Because I realized fairly recently, I went to Houston to the Astrodome to take books and other things to the people. And the police, a lot of them also African Americans, but you know, many other kinds of people as well, they came over and it was very clear that they, like the people who had lost their homes, really wanted some books. But they felt like they, as one of them said to me, I really would like a book, but I'm not the people, I'm the police. And I said to him, and then some of the people said that too, they said, you know, these people are the police, they're not the people. However, I said to the people and to the police that the police are the people. And we have to remember that the police are the people, as well as the people. And so, you know, there they were, these big guys who probably had not had anybody offer them a book to read in years, if ever. They had gone into the army and into the police force because they did not have an education. Now, that's part of why they're police. And so I really feel very strongly that as we go into this activity, more of it, which we will undoubtedly have to do, that we remember, even when the police are acting really, as we used to say down south, ugly, that we remember that they are also the people, and that this is, you know, we understand how they got to be the way that they are. And to try to hold that place of seeing them as the people, no matter what is happening.
I was reading Evelyn White's biography of you called Alice Walker, A Life. And she goes back to 1967. And you had just come to New York. And you were submitting an essay to American Scholar. It was 1967, so you were about, 23 years old. And it was entitled, The Civil Rights Movement, What Good Was It? And you include it in your book, In Search of Our Mother's Gardens. You wrote it in one sitting. You won first prize. It was published. The Civil Rights Movement, what good was it? Can you talk about the Civil Rights Movement to the anti-war movement? The anti-war movement, what good is it?
Well, as I was saying about the Civil Rights Movement, is that sometimes you can't see tangible results. You cannot see the changes that you're dreaming about because they're internal. And a lot of it has to do with the ability to express yourself, your own individual dream, your own individual road in life. And so we may never stop war. We may never stop war. And it isn't likely that we will, actually. But what we're doing as we try to stop war externally, what we're trying to do is stop it in ourselves. That's where war has to end. And until we can control our own violence, our own anger, our own hostility, our own meanness, our own greed, it's going to be so, so, so hard to do anything out there. So I think of any movement for peace and justice as something that is about stabilizing our inner spirit, so that we can go on and bring into the world a vision that is much more humane than the one that we have dominant today.
Speaking about movements, Rosa Parks just died, and it was the 50th anniversary, December 1st, of the Montgomery bus boycott. The corporate media, in describing Rosa Parks, talked about her as a tired seamstress who sat down on that bus, and when the white bus driver said, get up, she simply refused. She was tired. She was no troublemaker. But Rosa Parks, of course, was a troublemaker. Can you talk about the importance of movements and what it means to be an activist, why it doesn't diminish what you do, but actually add to Rosa's lifelong dedication. It adds to her reputation and her legacy.
Well, I was thinking about Rosa Parks because I was in Africa when she died, and I missed everything.
Where were you?
I was in Senegal, in a little village south of Dakar.
What were you doing there?
I was visiting this great African writer, Ayikwe Arma, who wrote a famous and wonderful book called 2,000 Seasons, which I recommend to everyone. He's a great, great writer. But when I got back and I realized that she had died, I didn't actually feel like doing anything. I waved. I waved to her. And what I remembered about her was when the last time that I had seen her, which I would like to talk about, because there was the public image. And one of the reasons I wrote a book like Meridian is that I lived through that period of the civil rights movement in the South. And a lot of the images were just that, they were images, but there was a lot happening behind the scenes. So with Rosa Parks, one day in Mississippi, we happened to be at the same event. I think she was being honored for you know, everything that she had given us. And we were at the same table. And I think I may have offered to escort her to the restroom. And I was in there with her. And while she was, you know, getting herself together to go back out into the reception or whatever the thing was that we were doing, she suddenly took down her hair. And Rosa Parks had hair that came all the way down to her, you know, the lower back. And she quickly ran her fingers through it, and I was just stunned. I had no idea. And she then, you know, twisted it up again, and she put it the way you've seen her, you know, always with the little bun, very neat. And I said to her, my goodness, what's all this? Miss Rosa. And she looked at me and she said, well, you know, I'm part Choctaw. And my hair was something that my husband dearly, dearly loved about me. He loved my hair. And she said, and so when he died, I put it up and I never wear it down in public. Now there is a Rosa. So I then, as you know, writers, artists, you know, we live by stealth. And so I immediately had this completely different image of this woman, the little quiet seamstress, you know, sitting on the bus, even the activist, you know, who was so demure and so correct. And I thought, this woman, hallelujah, was with a man who loved her and loved her with her hair hanging down. And she loved him so much that when he died, she took that hair that he loved and she put it up on her head and she never let anyone else see it. Isn't that amazing? So to answer your question, for me to be active in the cause of the people, you know, and of the earth, and you know, just to be, is to be alive. There is no compartmentalization. It's all one thing. It's not like I just exist to go into a little room and write. People have that image of writers, that's how we live, but it's not really accurate. Not the kind of writing that I do. I know that what I write has a purpose. You know, even if it's just for me, if I'm just trying to lead myself out of a kind of darkness. So it broadens everything, being active in the world. You see the world. It's like, you know, I'm learning to paint now. And what I realize learning to paint is that I'm learning to see. And activism is like that. When you are active, and you must know this so well, that the more you are active, the more you see, the more you go to see. You know, you are curious. One thing leads to another thing, and it gets deeper and deeper, too. And there's no end to it.
How do you write?
What do you mean?
Well, Isabel Allende said that she starts each new book on the same day of the year. I can't remember the date. Maybe it was January 9th, something like that.
Mm-hmm. I think it is.
What about you? What is your process? How do you focus?
I start each book when it's ready. And never before. And what I do is I try to find, if it's forming, you know, and if I'm attentive to my dreams, I know that it's coming, and I know that it's time to take a year or two. And in the early days, the big challenge was finding the financing to do that, because it, you know, for many years I was a single mother. I was, you know, lecturing and making a living that way, or teaching. And so I had to think hard and plan and some of my early journals are just pages of additions of, you know, how much this cost and how much that cost and how much is left at the end of the month and whether I can afford this and that. So that was the challenge, to find the time, because what I understand completely is that you, in order to invite any kind of guest, including creativity, you have to make room for it. You have to make that room. And so when I learned that, and I learned that partly through meditation, which I've done for many years, that you can really clear yourself of so much that's extraneous to your purpose in life, so that there's room for what is important to your spirit. It's something that has to be given space, and something that has to be given voice.
How did you start The Color Purple?
I got a divorce. I got a divorce because I really knew that I could not stay in my marriage and write about these wild women. And also, I left New York, and it started really just because one of the characters, while I was walking through Manhattan, said through my consciousness, you know, it's not going to work here. We are just not the kind of people who would come forth in Manhattan. So they basically carried me through, you know, all this incredible anguish of divorce, because I, unlike many people who divorce out of hatred or, you know, anything, I actually love my husband very much. He's a very, very good person. But I needed to write this book. And he claimed that the hills in San Francisco made him nauseous. So I came here and I ended up in Boonville because I needed to be in the country. And so I, you know, had enough money to work on it for maybe a year because I got a Guggenheim grant, $13,000. And I just headed for, you know, the hills. We rented a little cottage in an apple orchard, and I didn't know how long it would take, but it took just about a year.
Did you ever envision then the kind of impact it would have on the world? Did you think about the people you were writing it for?
Oh, I thought about the people I was writing it for. The people I was writing it for are the people who are in the book. That's who I was writing it for. It never crossed my mind to really be that concerned about the people who would be reading it now. And that's still true. I mean, I'm happy that people relate to it and love it. I think it's worthy of love. But my contract was always really with the people in it and whether I could make them live in the way that they deserve to live. And it was a very high experience to be able to do that. And when I wrote the last page, I burst into tears just from gratitude and love of them. And of being, you know, I don't know how many of you know the work of Gene Toomer. He's just a wonderful writer. But he talks about how in every generation, there is one person, or he puts it, the metaphor is there's one plum left on the tree, and all the other plums, you know, are gone with the wind and so forth. And there's this one plum, and that plum with one seed, that's all you need, really, to start it all over again. And that's another reason for us to be more hopeful about life. So I really had that feeling of being this one plum with this one seed, because from what I could see, there wasn't anybody else who had the same kind of love for these particular people that I had, or the capacity to be faithful to the vision of them that I held. So I felt very blessed and very chosen in a way, you know, like my ancestors were really present with me the entire time I was writing. They never went away. They were just really there. And I have felt their caring, and I still feel it. And it means that I never feel alone. It's impossible.
For someone who hasn't read the book, for a young person who's wondering why they should bother picking up a book, let alone The Color Purple, what would you say it's about?
Well, I was just in Molokai last week. I just got back a few days ago. And Molokai is the island that is least known among the islands. And it's because it used to be a leper colony. And there are actually lepers who still live there. And I was looking through a book about Molokai and about Kalapapa, which is where the lepers are. And there was a photograph of this man who had leprosy. And leprosy had eaten away his nose and most of his mouth and his ears and a lot of his, you know, face. And he just had this incredibly beautiful, beaming face. What was left of his face was just completely aglow. And what he said he had learned from living in this place of lepers all of his life was that the most horrible things can happen to people and they can still be happy. So I feel that when you read The Color Purple, no matter what is happening in your life or how difficult the whole huge miasma of sorrow that seems to be growing, there is a way that you can see through the life of Seeley that if you can continue and if you can stay connected to nature and also to your highest sense of behavior toward yourself and toward other people, if you can really keep that struggle going, you may not always win it. You remember how Seeley said to Sophia, said to Harpo at some point that he should beat Sophia, that he should beat his wife. Well, that was a low point. But she was still struggling to be someone who would outgrow that kind of thinking. And so what you learn is that life can be really hard. People can abuse you, people can, you know, take advantage of you in terrible ways. But there is something in the human spirit that's actually equal to that and can actually overcome that. And that is the teaching of The Color Purple.
You write in the same river twice, honoring the difficult. What I have kept, which the film avoided entirely, is Shug's completely unapologetic self-acceptance as outlaw, renegade, rebel, and pagan. Do you see yourself that way?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Why wouldn't I be? Why wouldn't I be? I know I'm very soft-spoken, but I have endeavored to live my life by my terms. And that means that I am a renegade, an outlaw, a pagan. What was the other thing?
A rebel.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And there's no reason not to rebel. I learned that really early. There is no reason whatsoever. You know, I don't look at television hardly at all, although now I'm saving it for my old age. But when I do see it, and I see how relentlessly we are being programmed, and I see, you know, how defenseless our young are, I realize all over again that rebellion, any way you can manage it, is very healthy. Because unless you want to be a clone of somebody that you don't even like, you know, you have to really wake up. I mean, we all do. We have to wake up. We have to refuse to be a clone of, you know, I don't know these, some of these people, they're just names to me, but, you know, I mean, I saw a young woman that everybody knows, you all know this woman, Britney Spears, or Spear. Anyway, you know, she was, I remember early on, the man who made the wonderful film, Michael Moore. Well, there was some program, and they actually had Michael Moore balanced by this woman. And Michael, of course, was saying, no, 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 we don't want this man to be president. My God, look what he's done. And she was saying, I think he's a wonderful man. So, yeah, rebel.
You've been listening to part one of Media Alliance's 30-year anniversary celebration. Please download part two to hear about the Harlem Writers Group and about Alice's journey to Florida to uncover the grave of Zora Neale Hurston. Media Alliance is a resource and advocacy center for media workers, nonprofit organizations, and social justice activists. Its mission is excellence, ethics, diversity, and accountability in all aspects of the media in the interests of peace, justice, and social responsibility. Among the services the Alliance has provided for its members are affordable health insurance and help with legal fees. The Alliance has been a powerful advocate for media accountability and is presently leading the fight for net neutrality and access to the Internet for all. You can check out its upcoming programs and classes at the website www.media-alliance.org. Thank you for listening. This is Carmen LaSalle for San Francisco Liberation Radio, a 24-hour, 7-day-per-week internet radio station available at www.liberationradio.net.